You're listening to a Bible study by Jack Kelly. For more free Bible study resources, visit our website at gracethroughfaith.com.
All right, in Daniel chapter 10, we're continuing this series of visions. This particular vision is going to take us all the way to the end of the book, so we're not going to get through it all tonight. We're going to see how far we go, and then whatever we don't get tonight, we'll have to do the next time. But basically, this chapter took place in 536 B.C. and is, along with its accompanying chapter 11, Daniel chapter 10 is really an introduction to Daniel 11. And you remember, I think I've told you before, that Daniel 11 contains, in the first 35 verses, 135 historically verified, fulfilled prophecies in just 35 verses. And so it's a very complex chapter, and we're going to have to go slowly and go through this in a very organized way in order not to walk away all confused about it, because it's going to cover a period of time of over 200 years. And as we get into it, you'll see what I'm talking about. But there's a lot of things going on. There's a lot of people involved. And it's basically the history of the Middle East from the time of Alexander's death until the time of the Maccabean Revolt. And so we got a couple hundred years there where the Middle East was very turbulent, where there was all kinds of stuff going on. There was a constant contention. In fact, in the book of Daniel, in the chapter we're going to read tonight, the angel describes it as one big war that lasted for all those 200 years, and from generation to generation to generation, it just kept going. And so Israel, of course, was stuck right in the middle of it. And so that's why it's in the Bible, and that's why it's interesting to us. And so let's begin with Daniel chapter 10. We'll get right into it, and we'll, like I say, we'll go as far as we can. I'm hoping to get through the first 35 verses of chapter 11 tonight as well. So let's get started. Daniel 10, verse 1, in the third year of Cyrus, the king of Persia. That means the third year after he conquered Babylon. Babylon was conquered in 539, and so that would have put it in 536 B.C., because you know in B.C. the numbers go, they get smaller as you go. And so 536 B.C., a revelation was given to Daniel, who was called Belteshazzar. That was the Babylonian name that King Nebuchadnezzar gave him when he first took him hostage back as a young teenager. Daniel's now almost 80 years old. And so the whole 70-year Babylonian captivity has passed here, and we're in the third year of the new Persian kingdom. Its message was true, and it concerned a great war. That's what I was talking about. It truly was a great war. And the understanding of the message came to him in a vision. And so Daniel has had this vision of this great war. Now, as we read on in verse 2, it says, at that time, I, Daniel, mourned for 3 weeks. I ate no choice food, no meat or wine touched my lips, and I used no lotions at all until the 3 weeks were over. That was the effect that this vision had on him. It so troubled him and so concerned him that he immediately went into a period of fasting to try and seek the Lord's understanding on this, so he could try and figure out what this all meant. And at the end of 3 weeks of fasting like this, it says in verse 4, on the 24th day of the first month, as I was standing on the bank of the great river, the Tigris, I looked up, and there before me was a man dressed in linen with a belt of the finest gold around his waist. His body was like chrysolite, and his face like lightning, and his eyes were flaming torches, and his arms and legs felt like the gleam of burnished bronze, and his voice sounded like the sound of a multitude. People have wondered about who this person is, because, of course, he's not named. And the description that Daniel gives of him here is very similar to the description John gave of the Lord Jesus in Revelation chapter 1, starting in verse 12. And so many people think that this was one of those pre-incarnate, if you will, visitations by the Lord Jesus to the planet Earth, and he had come to visit Daniel. Now, we're going to see that he's not the only one who came here, and so this is where the confusion comes in. So let's read on just a little bit. I'm not going to make a big case about whether this is Jesus or not, because, quite frankly, nobody knows. And if the Lord wanted us to know, he'd have had him write it down, wouldn't he? And so it isn't in there. And so all we can come to is the fact that it's very, very similar to this description of the Lord Jesus in Revelation chapter 1. But let's read on, because some other people are going to show up here, and we want to talk about them as well. In verse 7, I, Daniel, was the only one who saw the vision. The men with me did not see it, but such terror overwhelmed them that they fled and hid themselves. And so I was left alone, gazing at this great vision. I had no strength left. My face turned deathly pale, and I was helpless. And then I heard him speaking, and as I listened to him, I fell into a deep sleep, my face to the ground. Now, verse 10 says, a hand touched me and set me trembling on my hands and knees. You have to understand that this hand that touched him is not the Lord's hand, as we'll see in just a minute. So there's another person here, and this hand has reached out and touched him, and it's given him enough strength to get up onto his hands and knees. And verse 11 says, he said, Daniel, you who are highly esteemed, consider carefully the words I'm about to speak to you, and stand up, for I have now been sent to you. And when he said this to me, I stood up trembling. Verse 12, he then continued, do not be afraid, Daniel, since the first day you set your mind to gain understanding and to humble yourself before your God, your words were heard, and I have come in response to them. And verse 13 says, and this is how we know this second voice is not the Lord, says, but the prince of the Persian kingdom resisted me for 21 days. And then Michael, one of the chief princes, came to help me because I was detained there with the king of Persia. Now, of course, he's not talking about Cyrus, who's the human king of Persia. He's talking about a supernatural figure, just as the angel is a supernatural figure. Because, of course, Cyrus, the king of Persia, wouldn't have the power to detain an angel for 21 days. And so this is where we get the concept from. This is one of the few places in the Bible where we get the idea that behind every human throne on earth, there is a spiritual power. And that spiritual power influences events and controls things. 1 John 5:19 is something we ought to take a look at. So if you run right to the other end of the Bible, we'll look at 1 John 5:19, and it'll give you a little clarification here. And it's a verse that we need to keep in mind as we see things happening around us. 1 John 5:19 says, we know that we are children of God, and that the whole world is under the control of the evil one. Don't you just get a little bit frustrated when something bad happens and somebody else will come along and say, why did God let that happen? Why did God do that? And he gets the blame for everything, doesn't he? But do you understand that people say that because they don't know what's really going on in the world? They don't know what really the story is. They don't realize that when Adam and Eve were created, God gave them dominion over the earth. Genesis chapter 1 tells us that. And then when Adam and Eve sinned, they lost that. One of the things that the serpent came to visit them for was to steal the dominion of planet Earth back from them. And he did that. He accomplished that when they sinned. And since that point in time, Satan has had dominion over the earth. And the best proof I can give you for it is in Matthew chapter 4. And it's in Matthew chapter 4, verse 8. This is the temptation wilderness. Jesus is out in the wilderness. He's been fasting for 40 days, and the devil showed up to tempt him. The famous temptation of the Lord in the wilderness. In verse 8, it says, again, the devil took him to a very high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their splendor. In verse 9, he says, all this I will give you, he said, if you'll bow down and worship me. And Jesus said, away from me, Satan, for it's written, worship the Lord and serve your God and serve him only. Now, what did not Jesus say? He didn't say, you can't fool me, Satan. I know you don't own these things. They're not yours to give. Which he would have said had it been true. The Lord did not dispute Satan's claim to the kingdoms of the earth. He did not dispute that. When Satan said, these are mine and I can give them to anyone I want, I'll give them to you if you'll worship me, the Lord did not say, they are not yours. You can't give them to anybody. He did not say that because that wasn't true. One of the things the Lord came to do was to redeem the creation back from Satan. And in Romans chapter 8, we learn that that's one of the things he did. He redeemed it at the cross, but he has not yet taken possession of it. He will take possession of it in Revelation chapter 5 a few years from now. But you got to understand that. Satan stole planet Earth from Adam and Eve. He has been a usurper on the throne of Earth ever since. Jesus came to redeem us, but at the same time he came to redeem the creation. His blood has purchased its freedom just like it has purchased our freedom. But just like you and I are still here waiting to go and be with him, which is the promise that we were given, the creation is still under the bondage of Satan until the Lord in his good time comes back to take possession of, to repossess, if you will, that which he has paid for with his blood. And so when Satan said to Jesus, these kingdoms are mine, I can give them to anybody I want, I'll give them to you if you worship me. Jesus said only, no. It's written you should worship God and serve him only. He did not say the kingdoms aren't yours to give. And so that's the best proof we have of these things. And so the Bible tells us in these different places that dominion over the earth has been given to Satan by default, by subterfuge, by manipulation, by coercion, however you want to say it, is still true. When you see bad things happening in this world today, you can't blame God for that. He's as upset about it as you are. You can blame the evil that's in this world that came into the world through sin, and you can blame the active participation of Satan and his demonic hordes to try and make things as tough for us as he possibly can. He can't steal us away from God, but he tries to afflict us as whenever he can to make us miserable so that we won't influence anybody else to come to the Lord. But in the strength of the Lord, we can overcome that. In the strength of the Lord, he said in John 16:33, in this world you will have trouble, but take heart, because I've overcome the world. And so one day he can do that for us, and one day he will do that for us when it suits his purpose to do so. A lot of people say, well, what's he waiting for? Why didn't he come along and just do it? Well, how long have you been saved? How long have you been saved? What happens if he'd have come the day before you got saved? Then how would you feel? You see, he's 2 Peter 3:10 says he's not slow, as we would think of slowness. He's patient with us. He wants us all to be saved. He doesn't want any of us to be lost, and so he's waiting and waiting and waiting. But one day, time will be up, and then he'll come. The whistle will blow, the game will be over, and he'll come and straighten everything up. But you've got to understand that this world is an evil place, and this world has been captured by the prince of darkness, and he has somebody behind the throne of every kingdom on earth. He has since the beginning, he has today. There's a king of the United States, there's a king of Europe, there's a king of Israel, there's a king of Iraq, there's a king of Iran, and they're all demonic forces, all of them. It doesn't sound good to say that about our country, but it's true. They're all demonic forces. And what they're trying to do is consolidate their power and their authority to prevent the Lord from coming back and reclaiming things. And the way it looks like, if they let them go long enough, we'd all be destroyed and there wouldn't be anything to come back after. And so what does the Lord say in Matthew 24? He says, for the sake of the elect, I will come back and I will save them. So this prince of Persia that the angel is talking about in Daniel chapter 10, is a demonic force behind the throne controlling events in the Persian kingdom. The force behind the throne of Persia was so strong that the angel was not able on his own to subdue him. And so it says, then Michael, one of the chief princes, came to me to help me because I was detained there with the king of Persia. Michael is the archangel Michael. He's the captain of the Lord's host. He's the general of the army that controls all of the angelic warriors in heaven. And he himself came and helped this angel overpower this spirit called the king of Persia. A little later on, he's going to explain some things to Daniel, he's going to say, now I got to go back and continue my fight with the king of Persia. It's not over yet. And when I'm done with him, I'll have to fight with the king of Greece. It's because it's going to go on and on and on. And he could have said the king of this and the king of that and the king of something else all the way down to the end of the age, because there's always that kind of contention going on in the world. Now, if this is new information to you, I apologize. Somebody should have told you this a long time ago. But if you're familiar with that, then that's good. That shows that you've been well taught. Now, it says in verse 14, Daniel 10, "Now I have come to explain to you what will happen to your people." Now, who are Daniel's people? Who are Daniel's people? The Jews, yeah. So he says, "I'm going to explain what will happen to your people in the future." So we're talking about something that's going to happen to Israel in the future. And, of course, the future is sometime after 536 B.C. "I will explain to your people in the future, for the vision concerns the time yet to come." Verse 15, "While he was saying this to me, I bowed with my face toward the ground and was speechless. And then one who looked like a man touched my lips, and I opened my mouth and began to speak." We think this was still another angel. "And I said to the one standing before me, I am overcome with anguish because of the vision, my Lord, and I am helpless." Verse 17, "How can I, your servant, talk with you, my Lord? My strength is gone, and I can hardly breathe." Verse 18, "Again, the one who looked like a man touched me and gave me strength. Do not be afraid, O man highly esteemed," he said, "peace, be strong now, be strong. And when he spoke to me, I was strengthened, and I said, speak, my Lord, since you have given me strength." Verse 20, "So he said, do you know why I have come to you? Soon I will return to fight against the prince of Persia, and when I go, the prince of Greece will come. But first, I will tell you what is written in the book of truth. No one supports me against them except Michael, your prince." And then chapter 11, verse 1, "And in the first year of Darius the Mede, I took my stand to support and protect him." All right, so that's the end of chapter 10. And you see, it's just kind of the threshold, the front door here. Now what's going to happen next is we're going to get the explanation for the vision that Daniel's had. We haven't been told what the vision is yet, only that he's had one. It troubled him greatly, so much so that he went immediately into fasting and prayer, asking the Lord for an understanding of it. The Lord dispatched these angels to give him the understanding. The demonic forces tried to prevent the angels from coming, but they got through, and now they're going to explain to Daniel this vision that caused him so much trouble. All right, chapter 11, and now we're in verse 2. Now, here's where it gets very complicated, very complex, I should say, more than complicated. And I have found, I've taught this chapter so many times now, I have found that the best way to do it is for me to read it to you and insert the historical names of the people that are being talked about. Because all this chapter, we're going to be talking about the heads of two governments. One is called by the angel the king of the north, and the other is called by the angel the king of the south. And that's all they're called, the king of the north, king of the south. And yet, the vision spans several hundred years. And so it's not just one person who's the king of the north, or another person who's the king of the south. It is two families going through half a dozen or so generations of fathers handing kings to sons and sons to their sons and so on. And it gets confusing because you start thinking, well, wait a minute, who's the king of the north and who's the king of the south and what are we talking about here? And so I will read the chapter to you, and each time we come to the name of somebody, I'll tell you what that person's name is in history. This is where many of these 135 prophecies are fulfilled, because historians have gone through this chapter and have attached the names of the actual rulers from world history into the passage so that we know what's going on and who's going on. This chapter of Daniel has been the most thoroughly researched chapter of any book in the Bible because of the fact that there are so many specific and fulfilled prophecies in it that theologians who don't believe in predictive prophecy have tried to state that this chapter was actually written much later by someone else. And he was writing it after it all had happened, because that's the only way, in their opinion, that he could be so specific about it. He's going to tell us family secrets here that the normal person would say can only be learned after the fact. Well, the people who believe in prophecy and believe that God can know the end from the beginning and knows the future before it happens, they also have researched it. And so this turns out to be the most thoroughly researched chapter in the Bible. And because of that, it is also the most specifically validated chapter in the Bible, because, of course, the more research you do in the Bible, the more you see it turns out to be true. And all you had to do this is you had to know a lot about world history, and you had to know something about the Bible, and you had to know what went on in the Middle East between about 500 B.C. and about 200 B.C. And if you knew all those things, you could piece this all together, and it turns out that it is so astonishingly accurate that many people can't believe that Daniel could have actually written it. But the evidence is in. The proof is that he did write it, just like God said he did. These were all written in 539 B.C., but came to pass in the 300 years beyond that, as we come closer to us. Now, you think that's incredible. When we get to verse 36, it's going to shift from history to prophecy, and we're going to learn in that same kind of detail some things that are going to happen that are still in our future. And that part we'll probably handle on our next meeting. We'll try to get through the history part tonight, and we'll try to get to do the prophecy part next time, so you can see how history converts to prophecy in there. And so, here's what we're going to do. And if you want to try and make notes on this, feel free, but I'll tell you that I've posted this on our website, and it would be a lot easier for you, and you'd avoid a lot of confusion if you just go to the website and copy it from there, because I have it all posted there, and we can show you where to go to get it and how to print it. So if you want the historical record on this to check it out for yourself or anything like that, you'll be able to get it. So you don't need to bother unless you want to write some things down. If you have a good study Bible, some of this stuff will be in your notes at the bottom of the page anyway, and so you may already have it. But let's just go now into Daniel 11, 1. Well, we read verse 1. Let's read verse 2, and we'll just take this as it comes to us. So I'm going to read Daniel 2 through 4. And those two verses say, "Now then, I tell you the truth, three more kings will appear in Persia, and then a fourth, who will be far richer than all the others. And when he's gained power by his wealth, he'll stir up everyone against the kingdom of Greece. And then a mighty king will appear who will rule with great power and do as he pleases. After he has appeared, his empire will be broken up and parceled out toward the four winds of heaven. It'll not go to his descendants, nor will it have the power he exercised, because his empire will be uprooted and given to others." That's Daniel 11, 2, 3, and 4. And so what he's saying to Daniel is, after this King Darius, and it was two of them really, Cyrus was the Persian, Darius was the Mede. There was a coalition member of Medes and Persians who conquered Babylon. The Persians are, today we know them as Iran, and the Medes are known today as the Kurds. And so you have those two groups still in the news today, and they're the descendants of these people that are being talked about here. And so the three who would follow Cyrus as the king of Persia were named Cambyses, who ruled from 530 to 522 B.C. Pseudo-Smerdis, these people have some interesting names, don't they? Who ruled only 1 year, 522 B.C., probably because nobody could pronounce his name. And then Darius the I, who ruled from 522 to 486 B.C. And so those are the three he's talking about. And now he says, and then a fourth one will come far richer than all the others. That fourth one was named Xerxes the I. And he ruled from 486 to 465 B.C. And the reason this guy is famous is because he is the subject of another book in the Bible. It's called the Book of Esther. He's the king who married Esther, and together they saved the Jews from annihilation during his reign. It doesn't talk about that here. You can go and read Esther and find out all about it, because the king in the story of Esther is King Xerxes, just like it says here. And 130 years later, well, let me back up a little bit. One of the things that the thing that does talk about Xerxes here is that he tried to conquer Greece and failed. Well, this came down through history because nobody would forget something like this. And so while the Persian king Xerxes was not successful in conquering Greece, the Greek king Alexander was successful in conquering Persia. And Alexander the Great defeated the Persians at the Battle of Gaugamela, effectively conquering the Persian Empire. And then when Alexander died a few years later, we've been through this in previous visions, his four commanding generals took over, and the account will now focus on the descendants of two of them. Those from the family of Seleucus are called the king of the north, and those from Ptolemy are called the king of the south. When Alexander would lay on his deathbed in Babylon, by the way, his four chiefs of staff, really, the four generals that ran his armies for him, came to him and said, when you die, who gets the kingdom? And Alexander said, give it to the strong. Well, they assumed that meant them. And so even though Alexander had a son, they pushed him aside. And these four generals took over the kingdom. And they're called, two of them are called the king of the north and the king of the south here. And these are the two we're going to be focused on. There was a king of the west and a king of the east, of course, but they sort of fell by the wayside. The king of the west was Cassander, and he went back home and he ruled over Macedonia and Greece. And he did a great job, and he created a dynasty for himself there, but you don't hear any more about him as it relates to Daniel 11 because he didn't do anything to impinge upon Israel. And the king of the east, whose name was Lysimachus, was not a very strong person, and he actually was defeated relatively soon afterwards by the Seleucids, the king of the north. And so pretty soon the king of the north got all of the lands that had belonged to the king of the east. And so even though the king of the north started off with only what we would call Syria today and parts of southern Turkey, he wound up with all of Asia Minor and all the way east, almost over to India. He wound up with Babylon, and he wound up with the eastern portion of the Persian kingdom. And so he became quite powerful. And he's the guy that we know of as the king of the north. He was the first king of the north. Now, the king of the south, his name is Ptolemy, and he was the fourth general. And he started off with Egypt and what they called in those days Palestine, what we know today as Israel. And so here you had this king of the north in the lands north of Israel and east of there. And then you had the king of the south in the lands south of Israel. And these two kings fought each other almost continuously for over 200 years. And guess who was stuck right in the middle of it? Israel. Whenever the king of the north wanted to attack the king of the south, he went through Israel. Whenever the king of the south wanted to attack the king of the north, he went through Israel. And usually they conquered Israel on the way. So whoever had it, would yield it to the other guy. when he got ready, he'd come and take it back. So Israel got bounced back and forth several times throughout this period of time. And so this is why it was such a heartache for Daniel, because he could see what was going to happen to his people and to his country. And so because this account can be verified in the historical record, and because the focus of our study is Daniel's end times prophecies, I'm just going to insert the names of the central characters and the dates and reigns where applicable, and I'll add a note or two as we go along. This will give us a hint of the incredible accuracy of the prophecies in Daniel 11, and will prepare us for the shift we're going to take probably next time from history to prophecy as we get to verse 36. By the way, what I'm reading to you here is from the website, so you can get this, basically this script right off the website if you want for your own personal use. Okay, now we're going to read Daniel 11, 5 and 6. Now it says, the king of the south, remember I said that was Ptolemy. He's Ptolemy the first, and he reigned from 323 to 285. He'll become strong, but one of his commanders, who is Seleucus the first, the king of the north, will become even stronger, and he'll rule his own kingdom, which was Babylon at the beginning, with great power. After some years, they'll become allies, the king of the north and the king of the south. Actually became allies. And the daughter of the king of the south, whose name was Bernice, who was the daughter of Ptolemy's son, you see it's getting confusing already, Ptolemy the second, will go to the king of the north, who is now Seleucus' son, Antiochus II, and they'll make an alliance. But she'll not retain her power, and he and his power will not last. And in those days she'll be handed over together with her royal escort and her father and the one who supported her. Now here's what that means. Ptolemy I and Seleucus I became allies. And they were going to cement this upon their deaths by the marriage of the daughter of one to the son of the other, the way royalty has done for generations. And so when Seleucus' son, whose name was Antiochus, married or was supposed to marry Ptolemy's daughter Bernice, he had a small problem. He was already married. And yet the two fathers had promised this as part of their agreement. And so Antiochus left his wife, whose name was Laodice. It was Laodice from whom the city of Laodicea gets its name. The city was named after her. Antiochus left his wife Laodice for Bernice to fulfill the obligation of the treaty. But Laodice decided she didn't like that idea, and she formed a conspiracy and had Antiochus, Bernice, and Bernice's father, Ptolemy II, all murdered. She killed them all. And so that took care of that. And that's what he's talking about there. And it says, she'll not retain her power, and he and his power will not last, and she'll be handed over together with her royal escort and her father. And what that means is that they were all murdered. And that's pretty common among royalty as well, isn't it? I mean, that's not the first time that's ever happened. Okay, and then it says in Daniel 11:7, one from her family line will arise to take her place. That turned out to be Bernice's brother, Ptolemy III. So we've had three Ptolemies so far. They're all king of the south. And what happens is Bernice's brother then went up to the north and killed Laodice to avenge his sister and father. You could make a beautiful soap opera out of this. I mean, it could be a great story, and it could last for a long time. He will attack the forces of the king of the north, who's by now Seleucus II, and we're up to 246, by the way, B.C., and enter his fortress, which was Antioch, and he'll fight against them and be victorious. He will also seize their gods, their metal images, and their valuable articles of silver and gold, and carry them off to Egypt. And for some years, he'll leave the king of the north alone. After he beats him, he takes all of his wealth out of his fortress, goes back home, and he takes a break. But then the king of the north will invade the realm of the king of the south, but he'll have to retreat to his own country. And his sons, who are now Seleucus III and Antiochus III, who's called Antiochus the Great, by the way, will prepare for war and assemble a great army, which will sweep on like an irresistible flood and carry the battle as far as his fortress. Now, his fortress was in the city of Raphia, which was in what we call today the Sinai Desert. So now we're down to, this happened all about 226. And then you go to verse 11 of Daniel 11. It says, then the king of the south, who's now Ptolemy the fourth, so we're down another generation, he reigned from 221 to 203, will march out in a rage and fight against the king of the north, who's still Antiochus the Great, Antiochus the Third. And he'll raise a large army, but it will be defeated. And this was in the Battle of Raphia in 217. When the army is carried off, he goes on, the king of the south will be filled with pride and will slaughter many thousands. According to the historian Polybius, there were 10,000 infantrymen killed in that battle. And yet he'll not remain triumphant, for the king of the north, who's still Antiochus, will muster another army larger than the first, and after several years he'll advance with a huge army fully equipped. And that's Daniel 11:11 through 13. And we're down to verse 12, and we're going to go through another Ptolemy here, and we're at about 203 B.C. Okay, Daniel 11:12. In those times, many will rise against the king of the south, who is now Ptolemy the fifth. Okay, so there have been five Ptolemies now, and this Ptolemy reigned from 203 to 181. And it says, the violent men among your own people, who of course Daniel's people, they're the Jewish people, will rebel in fulfillment of the vision, but without success. Because Ptolemy's general, whose name was Scopas, crushed this rebellion in 200 B.C., then the king of the north, who's still Antiochus the Great, will come and build up siege ramps and will capture a fortified city. And the forces of the south will be powerless to resist. Even their best troops will not have the strength to stand. The invader will do as he pleases. No one will be able to stand against him, and he'll establish himself in the beautiful land. Now, that's a euphemism always for Israel, the beautiful land. Israel was captured from the king of the south in 197 BC. So Israel now belongs to the king of the north. And it says he'll have the power to destroy it. He'll determine to come with the might of his entire kingdom and will make an alliance with the king of the south and give him a daughter. The daughter's name was Cleopatra, but she was Cleopatra the first. The Cleopatra we know about, who got in mixed up with Julius Caesar and then Mark Antony, that was Cleopatra the seventh. So this is Cleopatra the first. This is the original Cleopatra. And she, there were seven Cleopatras, well, actually more, because she had four children, and one of them was a girl, and she named her Cleopatra too. We'll do Cleopatra sometime. That's a fascinating story. But for now, we're on these other guys. Cleopatra I married Ptolemy V in 194 BC. And he gave, this was subterfuge, because the king of the north gave his daughter to Ptolemy in order to overthrow the kingdom. He's sending her down there to make them think they have peace, but his real intention is to lull him into a false sense of security so he can attack him. But it says his plans will not succeed or help him. Then it says he'll turn his attention to the coastlands and will take many of them. But a commander will put an end to his insolence and turn his insolence back on him. And after this, he'll turn toward the fortresses of his own country, but will stumble and fall to be seen no more. Okay, there's a couple of fascinating characters in here. And when it says, then he'll turn his attention to the coastland and take many of them, he teamed up with the Carthaginian general named Hannibal. You remember Hannibal from history? He teamed up with this guy, and they went after the Romans, but the Romans beat them. The Roman consul Lucius Cornelius Scipio Asiaticus is the name. He had four names. That's the name of the general that beat Antiochus III and Hannibal. Of course, Hannibal got his revenge later. But this Roman general beat them, and this Roman general had been asked, if you will, or had agreed to do this on behalf of Cleopatra and Ptolemy. And so they sided with the Romans against the king of the north, and because they knew they'd get beat otherwise, and the Romans, Rome was just coming on the scene at this time. They were kind of an upstart country, but they were pretty powerful, and the Romans, teaming up with the king of the south, defeated Hannibal and Antiochus, and actually, on his way back home, Antiochus died in another battle in 187, so he never made it. So now we're down to 187 BC, and we're come to Daniel 11, verse 20. And that one says, his successor, who is now Seleucus IV, will send out a tax collector to maintain the royal splendor. In a few years, however, he'll be destroyed, yet not in anger or in battle. And what happened here was this tax collector, whose name was Heliodorus, got to these rich people who he's collecting taxes from, and he made a deal with them, and they overthrew the government because it turns out that Heliodorus wound up with all the money. And you can't run the kingdom without the money, and Heliodorus was collecting the taxes, but he was keeping it, and so he had the backing of these wealthy families because he had promised them tax incentives, no doubt. And so when it says he was destroyed but not in anger or in battle, it means that Heliodorus overthrew the government, basically. He engineered a coup against him, as we'd say today. And Seleucus IV, it said, he will be succeeded by a contemptible person. Now, that contemptible person is Antiochus IV, who's better known as Antiochus Epiphanes. You may have heard that name. It's Antiochus Epiphanes who really went after the Jews in a bad way and brought about the so-called Maccabean Revolt, in which the king of the north was eventually defeated, again with the help of the Romans. But we're getting ahead of ourselves a little bit. Antiochus IV, Epiphanes, he ruled from 175 to 164. He had not been given the honor of royalty because he wasn't next in line for succession. It should have been Seleucus IV's brother who became the king, but he was too young, and so Antiochus pushed him aside and just kind of grabbed the kingdom, took it over. Actually, it says he mounted a palace revolt against the rightful heir, whose name is Demetrius I, and you don't hear any more about him. at least not in Daniel 11. You hear more about him in history because he was a legitimate ruler during the time. Now, this Antiochus IV, Antiochus Epiphanes we should call him, he'll invade the kingdom when its people feel secure. The kingdom is Israel. And he'll seize it through intrigue. Then an overwhelming army will be swept away before him, and both it and a prince of the covenant will be destroyed. And so Antiochus destroys this army. The prince of the covenant they're talking about is Onias III. He was the last legitimate high priest in Israel. And this is another story of intrigue. The high priest, you know, exerted enormous power and influence in Israel because there really wasn't a king. The high priest was really the final say. Even when there was a king, the king always deferred to the high priest because the high priest is the one who spoke directly with the Lord. It was very influential, very powerful. Onias was not happy about the fact that the Greek influence was starting to come into Jewish society. And Jewish men were starting to shave. They were starting to cut their hair shorter. They were throwing away their robes and starting to wear Greek-style togas and things like that. And many of them were taking Greek names. And they believed in an appeasement program, which basically said that if we relax our standards, if we yield to these people, and if we adopt some of their customs, then maybe they'll be okay with us and we can all get along. You've heard this story before, and it's not the last time that ever happened either. In fact, and many people see it going on today, in fact, with the policies of appeasement in the hopes that the other side will settle down. And of course, they never do. They always get meaner. And that's exactly what happened here. But Onias III, the high priest, was opposed to this. And he was of the opinion that this was wrong. And he did everything he could to stop it. And being the high priest, he had quite a bit of authority. But his own brother, whose name was Joshua, got jealous of Onias' authority and his position. And Joshua was one of these types who had shaved off his beard, cut his hair, and had started wearing the Greek-style clothing. And he'd actually taken a Greek name. Instead of calling himself Joshua, he changed his name to Jason. And he went to Antiochus Epiphanes and said, if you'll make me the high priest, I'll give you a bunch of money and I will murder my brother. Get him out of the way for you. Then you can complete the process of Hellenizing, as it was called, the Jewish kingdom. Antiochus took the money. He agreed. Jason killed his brother Onias. And that was the last time. This was around 170, around in there. Yeah, 170. That was the last time Israel had a legitimate high priest. From that point on, the office of high priest went to the highest bidder. And whoever was the emperor, if he wasn't happy with the current high priest, he would just put out the bid and sell the office to somebody else. This, by the way, is why, and I should follow on and say, and the Romans, they adopted that practice when they took over later on. And this is why, when on the night Jesus was arrested, the first trial was at the home of Annas, who's the father-in-law of Caiaphas, because Annas had been the high priest until very recently when he did something to displease the Romans. And so they terminated his office and put the office out to bid. And Caiaphas was the high bidder, and that's how he became the high priest. So he wasn't even thought by the Jewish people to be a legitimate priest. Neither was Annas, by the way, because he had bought the office himself, but at least he was trying to be decent about it. And so when they first captured Jesus, the first trial was at the home of Annas. And then he went to Caiaphas, and then he went to Herod, and then he went back to Caiaphas. And then there were six trials that night, basically, during that period from the time he was taken in the Garden of Gethsemane to the time he was beaten in the morning and then brought up to be put on the cross. He went through six trials, none of them legal. Every one of them resulted in a conviction based on false testimony. We could go into that story too, because all the rules over the years, the Jews were legendary for their mercy and for their willingness to give everybody the benefit of the doubt. If even one person of the panel of judges voted not to kill somebody, they let him go. If if anybody had any difficulties about it at all, they assumed that that was not God's will, and they let the person go. They had a so-called sleep on it rule, where they could never convict a guy at the same meeting where they meant to hear the evidence. They always had to go home, sleep on it, pray about it, come back the next day, and meet again. They violated all those rules for Jesus, and so it was one of the most out of character series of events for the Jewish people ever in their history. But that's what happened. And so that's again another story, but you should be aware of the reason. Why did they take him to Annas and then Caiaphas and then go back and forth like that? But the last legitimate high priest was Onias III. From that point on, the highest bidder got it, and the office of high priest was traded back and forth among the wealthiest families in Israel from that point forward, because it was a very lucrative business. And they always, you know, you might wonder, why would somebody spend $30 million running for the U.S. Senate for a job that pays $100,000 a year? And so if he has the job for 6 years, he makes $600,000. Why would he pay $30 million to get that job? Because it's not the salary that's important. It's all the influence. It's the fact that he can become a lobbyist after he gets done in the Senate. And if he doesn't want to wait that long, he can always collect a little money on the side during the term of office. And as long as he doesn't get caught, everybody's happy. He'll recoup that. That's the best investment he can make. And that's why they're willing to spend so much money to get to the office, because it's so lucrative once they get there. Okay, so that's 170. Now, by the way, this fulfilled the prophecy of Ezekiel 21, I think it's in verse 25. Where the Lord said, in conjunction with the Babylonian captivity, I'm going to suspend the office of king. And Jeconiah was the last king of Israel, and he's the one who was defeated by the Babylonians. And the Lord said, there won't be another king in Israel. And he put a curse, basically put a curse, on the royal line of Solomon. A blood curse, saying no son of that line would ever sit on the throne of David again. But remember, he had promised David that somebody would sit on his throne forever. He said, I'll give you an everlasting kingdom. There will always be a descendant of yours on the throne of Israel. Then he goes and pronounces a blood curse on the line because of how bad the kings have gotten. And he said, Jeconiah, you're the last one. There will never be another one. And since the Babylonian captivity in 605, when Jeconiah was defeated by Nebuchadnezzar's army, since then, Israel's never had a king. After the Babylonian captivity, they come back together. Zerubbabel, he was not the king, he was just a governor. And they always had an office like that. But they never had a king again, haven't had one to this day. Ezekiel 21:26 said, take the crown off that man and don't give it to anybody else until the one who deserves it comes for it. And then he said, and take the turban off that guy. Now the crown was worn by a king, the turban was worn by the high priest. And so Ezekiel had prophesied that both the office of king and the office of priest would be suspended. Then in Zechariah, I think it's in chapter 6, we learn that one person is going to come, and to him will be given both the crown and the turban. And it says the two will be one. And of course, that's the Messiah. That's the Lord. He will be the king and the priest, both of them. And he's the one that Ezekiel was talking about as being the one who deserves this. And so until Jesus comes again and sits on the throne of David in Israel, there won't be a king there, and there won't be a priest there. Jeconiah was the last king. He reigned until 605, or maybe it was 586, but right around in there. Onias III was the last priest. Never since. Now it says that after coming to an agreement with him, and this is what I just told you about, he'll act deceitfully, and with only a few people he'll rise to power. This is the business with Onias III and his brother Jason and so on. And it says, when the richest provinces feel secure, he'll invade them and will achieve what neither his fathers or his forefathers did. He'll distribute plunder and loot and wealth among his followers, and he'll plot the overthrow of fortresses, but only for a time. When Antiochus came, let me see if I should tell you that right now. Oh, no, let's go on one more. Let's read Daniel 11, and we'll read 25 through 28 now. It says, this is Antiochus IV, Antiochus Epiphanes. With a large army, he'll stir up his strength and courage against the king of the south, who is now Ptolemy VI. So there have been six Ptolemies now in the last 200 years. Those guys didn't live very long. The king of the south will wage war against him. with a large and very powerful army, but he will not be able to stand because of the plots devised against him. Those who eat from the king's provisions, which means Ptolemy's own family, will try to destroy him, and his army will be swept away, and many will fall in battle. The two kings, who are Antiochus IV and Ptolemy VI, with their hearts bent on evil, will sit at the same table and lie to each other. This is called diplomacy, right? The definition of diplomacy is when two people with opposing views sit down together and agree to something neither one of them wanted. That's diplomacy. And that's what happened there. It says they'll sit at the same table and lie to each other, but to no avail, because an end will still come at the appointed time. You see, the Lord's got all this in view, and he knows how this is all going to work out. And even though these men think they're so powerful and they think they can go off and do anything they want, he sees how it's going to work out, and he sees that they don't have anywhere near the power they think they have. It's all going to work out the way he says, not the way they think. The king of the north will return to his own country with great wealth, but his heart will be set against the Holy Covenant, and he'll take action against it and then return to his own country. On his way back to Syria, Antioch, where his throne was, his capital, Antiochus, this was in 169 BC now, Antiochus Epiphanes plundered the temple in Jerusalem and killed several thousand priests. Okay, so that brings us up to Daniel 11, verse 28. Now, we start with 29, and we'll read 29 and 30. At the appointed time, he'll invade the south again. This is Antiochus, he's still around now. He'll invade the south again, but this time the outcome will be different from what it was before. Ships of the western coastlands, that's Rome, will oppose him, and he'll lose heart. And then he'll turn back and vent his fury against the Holy Covenant. Now, according to history, Antiochus was standing on the shores of Egypt. He had gotten down there with his ships and everything, brought his army ashore, and they're ready to invade Egypt. When they look on the horizon back over their heads to the Mediterranean, and they see another fleet of ships coming, and that fleet of ships surrounds them there on the shoreline. And the Roman commander, Popilius Laenas, got off one of the ships, came ashore, and confronted Antiochus there. And he said, "We've got you behind. The Egyptians have you. They're ahead of you. So basically, you're surrounded, and you're way overpowered." He said, "I want you to consider surrendering. If you do, you can go home. No battle, no harm, no foul. You can go home." Antiochus Epiphanes said, "Well, let me think about this." And the Roman commander said, "Fine." And he took out his sword, and he drew a circle in the sand around Antiochus. And he said, "Take all the time you want, but if you step outside the circle, you're dead, unless you're stepping outside the circle to go home." And there was Antiochus stuck. There was nothing he could do. He was surrounded, his forces outnumbered, and although it burned him, as you can imagine, he surrendered, sent his armies back on the ships, and they went home. But he was so angry that on the way home, they stopped in at Israel, and they broke into the temple, slaughtered all the priests. And that's not all he did. He then outlawed the practice of the Jewish religion. It was punishable by death to practice the religion. He forbade them from the regular sacrifices that they're supposed to do. Instead, he had them start sacrificing unclean animals, including pigs, on the altar in Jerusalem. And if you know anything about how the Jews feel about pigs, you know how that went over. He outlawed possession of the Hebrew Scriptures. And so if you were caught with a Bible, off with your head. He committed unspeakable atrocities against the Jewish people and actually set about to annihilate the Jews. He broke into the temple and he had a statue of the Greek god Zeus created with his own face on it. And he put that statue in the temple and he required them to bow down and worship it on pain of death. This is where the name Epiphanes comes from, because Epiphanes means God made manifest, or God in the flesh. And so he said, "My name is Antiochus. I am God in the flesh." Well, when he demanded these kinds of things, it made the temple unfit for use. And for the first time in history, the temple had to close because of the fact that it had been made desolate. It had been polluted, contaminated, however you want to put it, by the worship of false gods there. Antiochus went out into the neighboring cities and he had the people construct altars there, and he had them sacrifice in these unclean ways in the different places, cities around Jerusalem as well. And the policy of appeasement, you remember, where so many people wanted to get along. And now, of course, Onias is dead. His brother Jason, who is pushing this Hellenization of Israel, is the high priest. And so he encouraged the other priests to go along with this. And he said there wasn't nothing wrong with it. It wouldn't hurt anything. And so some Assyrian soldiers came into the little town outside of Jerusalem called Modin, and they had the people there erect an altar, and they were going to sacrifice a pig there, just like they had in these other places. And they got a priest to come forward and do it. And just as the priest was about to sacrifice the pig on the altar they had built, a man named Mattathias came out of the crowd with a spear, or a sword rather, and he killed both the Syrian soldier and the priest. And then he tore apart the altar, and then he ran out of town, and his family with him. He had a son whose name was Judas in the Greek, but Judah in the Hebrew, and his nickname was the Hammer, because he was a tough guy. He's powerful, and he was a hothead, and he was the perfect guy to lead a rebellion. In fact, in the Hebrew, Judah the Hammer is Judah Maccabee. And so this became known as the Maccabean Revolt. And over the next 3 years, the Maccabees fought a guerrilla war against Antiochus Epiphanes, and finally, with the help of the Romans, again, ran him out of Israel. And they went to the temple, they took the altar on which the pig had been sacrificed, and they hammered it into little stones, and they threw it down in the Kidron Valley. They took the statue of Zeus, and they ground it up until it was powder, and they put that in the Kidron Brook, the little stream that ran down through there, and it flowed away, and they built a new altar, and they went to the Bible for the purification ceremony that Solomon had used when he dedicated the temple, and they got out the oil, and they were starting on the ceremony that required the oil be burnt for 8 days to purify the temple, and they discovered they only had 1 day's worth of oil. And so they got together, and they decided, we will burn the day's worth that we have, and we'll hope the Lord calls it sufficient. And you know the story. The Lord kept that 1 day's worth of oil burning for the entire 8 days. The temple was purified, and they began to worship there again, and it was fit now for use by God again. That was the sign that he gave them. They felt so such a powerful feeling about all that they proclaimed a festival day for that, and they've celebrated it every year. Even to these days, it's called the Feast of Hanukkah, and that's where it originated, that the Feast of Hanukkah, the eight-day feast where they light a candle every day for 8 days, is in memory of the supernatural provision that God made for the burning of the oil to purify the temple. This happened in 165 B.C. Now, it turns out that these events very clearly preview what the Antichrist will attempt to do at the end of the age. Paul says in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, verse 4, that this Antichrist will come into the temple. He'll proclaim himself to be God. Revelation 12 and 13 say that they will erect a statue in the likeness of this Antichrist, and they'll require everybody to worship it on pain of death. And all these things that Antiochus did back then, the Antichrist will do again. In fact, it's such a clear parallel that in Matthew 24:15, Jesus said, when you see this happen at the end of the age, if you're in Israel and you're Jewish, run for the mountains, because that will be the start of the Great Tribulation. And from that point on, it won't be safe for you to be in Israel. You'll have to go into hiding. And so the events here in 165 brought about by Antiochus Epiphanes give us a very clear preview or picture of what the Antichrist will do in the days that lead up to the Great Tribulation at the end of the age. And Jesus said it's such a clear parallel that when you see it again, you'll recognize it, because it's only happened once before in history. And when you see it again, the same problems are going to start that started before. It's all out war, and we're going to have to get rid of this guy. It says his armed forces, this is 31 and 32, his armed forces will rise up to desecrate the temple fortress and abolish the daily sacrifice, and they'll set up the abomination that causes desolation, which they did in 168 BC. With flattery, he'll corrupt those who violated the covenant, But the people who know their God will firmly resist him. These were the Maccabees. Now, there was another group of Jewish believers here, along with the Maccabees, who came to be known as the Hasidim. The Hasidim were the ancestors of today's Hasidic Jews. I don't know if you're familiar with the Hasidic Jews. They're probably best known in the world for their skill at diamond cutting. They are the world's premier diamond cutters. They have a huge operation in New York City and another one in Belgium, I think it's in Antwerp. And they basically process the majority of the diamonds that come out of the mines in Africa and make them suitable for ladies to wear in rings on their hands. The Hasidic Jews are descendants of the Hasidim who remained faithful to God and were the ancestors, as I said, of the Hasidics. Now that they're mentioned there in Daniel 11:31 as being the people who know their God and firmly resist Antiochus. Now we're down to 33. Those who are wise will instruct many, though for a time they'll fall by the sword or be burned or captured or plundered. And when they fall, they'll receive a little help, and many who are not sincere will join them. The Maccabeans, who defeated Antiochus, cleansed the temple and restored Jewish autonomy, setting up the Hasmonean dynasty, which was really one of the most successful dynasties that ever ruled Israel. They actually got back all the lands that Solomon had once ruled over. The kingdom during the Hasmonean dynasty is as big as it's ever been. They still never actually conquered all of the land that God promised to Abraham way back in Genesis. But the kingdom got bigger than it's ever been during the time of the Hasmonean dynasty. But it was not a pure rule, and it became corrupt, and it kind of fell in on itself, and that happened about the time that Jesus came along, and that's when the Romans came in, and that's now we're getting into the New Testament times. And in verse 35, some of the wise will stumble so that they may be refined and purified and made spotless until the time of the end, for it will still come at the appointed time. Now, the writer to the Hebrews wrote about these people in chapter 11, you know, the great chapter on the faith, and I want to read to you what he had to say. I'm one of those people who believe that Paul probably wrote the book of Hebrews, and so if it was him, you can imagine him saying this, but it's not necessary to believe that Paul wrote it for you to get the picture of how these people were perceived. In Hebrews 11, we're going to look at starting in verse 36. Some faced jeers and flogging, while still others were chained and put in prison. They were stoned, which is the method of execution. They were sawed in two. The tradition says that Isaiah was sawed in two. King Manasseh, or Manasseh as it's called in Hebrew, stretched him out between two horses, and while the horses tried to pull him apart, they sawed him down through the stomach and sawed him in half, and each of the horses dragged half of him away in opposite directions. That was how Isaiah was put to death. And so others were killed that way. They were put to death by the sword. They went about in sheepskins and goatskins, destitute, persecuted, and mistreated. In verse 38, he says, the world was not worthy of them. They wandered in deserts and mountains and in caves and in holes of the ground. In verse 39, these were all commended for their faith, yet none of them received what had been promised. For God had planned something better for us, so that only together with us would they be made perfect. You see, it wasn't until the Lord came and brought his church together into the world that all of these promises made to all the faithful down through the ages of Israel could come true. Because nothing they did, no matter how great it was, no matter how faithful they were, nothing they did could gain them what you and I have been promised, because Jesus had not been to the cross yet. The sacrifice of the bulls and goats and sheep and everything all done all through those years was not sufficient to cleanse them of their sins. It was only sufficient to set their sins aside so that they didn't have to be judged for them. And even then, it was only sufficient if they'd made their sacrifices in faith that a Redeemer would come one day and cleanse them. A lot of people talk about the sacrificial system and how it was the salvation by works through the law. But you know, the Bible tells us that it was only if they held to the faith that a Redeemer was coming. Only then did those sacrifices avail to them. When they didn't believe it, when they just went through the motions and did the sacrifices without the faith, those sacrifices became abominations to God. He rejected them. And he said to them, like he did in Isaiah, when you sacrifice a lamb, it's like you sacrificed a pig on the altar or a dog. And he says, it's disgusting to me because, you see, he never wanted the sacrifices. The sacrifices were necessary to hold his judgment back until the Redeemer could come and shed his blood, the only blood that counts. But if they didn't have the faith in that, if they didn't believe that when they sacrificed the lamb, it was a model of the Redeemer coming, the Lamb of God who really takes away the sin of the world. If they didn't believe that, the sacrifice didn't do any good for them at all. You know, the most complex religious system ever developed, worshipped in the most expensive building ever built by the most dedicated people on the face of the earth for over 1,000 years. And how many people were saved by that system? None. Zero. Because right from the beginning, it was known that the blood of the Redeemer would save them. And that these things that they were doing were acting out their faith in that coming Redeemer. If they made the sacrifice knowing, believing that they were making a model of the Redeemer, then it availed to them. But if they just went through the motions, nothing. Didn't do them any good at all. Look at Isaiah 29:13. You don't have to take my word for any of this, which is always a safe way to go. Don't take my word for any of this. Check the scriptures, see what they say. I think it's 29. Yeah, it's 29. Yeah, it's 29:13. Here's what he says about the people who practice the religion without the faith. He could say that about people today who practice the religion without the faith, right? He said in verse 13, these people, notice he doesn't say my people. He says, these people, they come near to me with their mouth and they honor me with their lips, but their hearts are far from me. And their worship of me is made up only of rules taught by men. That was his opinion about the religion when it's practiced without faith. And he says, verse 14, therefore I will astound these people with wonder upon wonder, and the wisdom of the wise will perish, and the intelligence of the intelligent will vanish. And so what he's talking about, of course, he's going to bring the Redeemer, and he's going to show them. And when he did, was it the intelligent? Was it the intellectual? Was it the theologian who accepted the Lord? No. They all said, well, it doesn't say that in the book, I don't think. It was the common people. It was the simple people. It was the ones like you and me who didn't know enough not to believe it. And in Paul, using these verses as a quote, he says, the foolishness of God is wiser than the wisdom of man. Okay, but you see the point here. None of them received the promise, and they can't until we do. We're the favored ones. We're the ones who come first in God's eyes because our belief is solely by faith. We don't see big miracles around us all the time. We don't see lightning coming down from heaven. We don't see the earth opening up and devouring people. We don't see the Red Sea parting. We don't see any of that in our day. On the night when Thomas came and bowed before Jesus and saw the marks in his hands and in his side, and he says, my Lord and my God. Remember what Jesus said to him? He said, you believe because you've seen. He said, blessed are those who have not seen and yet believe. He's talking about us. Because we don't get to see the physical evidence of all that. We've all had our moments where our faith has been confirmed, but the faith came first, didn't it? We first believe by faith. And then maybe once in a while we see some confirmation that is meaningful to us, and it was designed to undergird our faith. But would we have seen it without the faith? No, I don't think so. Because the people around who have no faith see the same things, and that doesn't do them any good. It's the faith that makes it. And because we have believed by faith alone, we become the favored ones. And when we get our reward, then they can get theirs. Isn't that interesting how that has happened that way? All right, let's see. We've got a couple more verses here, have we? Are we down to the... No, that's as far as I wanted to get to tonight. And look at that. We've run out of time anyway. And so it's a good place for us to... And so we're going to stop here at 11:35. And the remember, as I told you at the beginning, the first 35 verses of this are all history. These can all be verified in history. All these names I've given you and the times of their reigns and the sons and daughters and the wives and concubines and the ones who killed this guy and the ones who killed that guy and all that, that can all be verified in secular history. 135 events that we've talked about here tonight can be verified in secular history. They all took place 200 to 300 years after Daniel received them and wrote them down for us. It is the most concentrated and specific passage of prophecy anywhere in the Scripture. So, let's have a closing prayer.
Thanks for listening to this study. For more free Bible study resources, visit gracethroughfaith.com.